your online community for positive change. Seventh Wave Network.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dream. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education, with your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. This program will give parents and educators the skills and methods to effectively advocate for children today. And now, here's Rich and Michelle.
Hello, everyone. This is Rich Weinfeld. Unfortunately, Michelle Davis won't be with us today, but she'll be back next week. I want to start off by talking about our show in general. Michelle and I believe that with high expectations and an education system that works, all children can achieve. From our show, parents will learn how to partner with the school to powerfully and effectively advocate for their children. Educators listening to the show will advance their skills and knowledge to effect positive changes in both other educators and also in their school communities. We're very excited about our show today. We have two wonderful guests, Samantha and Betsy A. Beal. We're calling today's show Stand Up for Your Child, A Mother and Daughter's Perspective, and let me tell you a little bit about what the show will focus on. What options do parents have when things are not working for their children at school? What is the importance of focusing on the child's strengths? How involved should parents be at different points in their child's lives? Samantha A. Beal, author of My 13th Winter, and her mother, Betsy A. Beal, will tell the story of their journey through Samantha's education together, including the story of how Reach for the Moon, authored by Samantha when she was 13, a gifted student struggling with learning and emotional challenges, came to be. We'll be bringing Samantha and Betsy on in our second segment, but first, as we do weekly, we want to talk about hot topics in education, and I'm happy to be joined once again today by Mark Beatty from the 2E newsletter. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rich. Thanks for having me on the show again.
We're glad to have you. And just for folks who may not have heard other shows or might not be familiar, can you just tell us real briefly about the 2E newsletter?
Sure. 2E newsletter is twice exceptional. 2E twice exceptional newsletter. It's for parents and educators and counselors who work with high-ability kids who are not achieving to their full potential because of learning differences, learning disabilities, whatever barrier they might have. And it's a bi-monthly, 24-page electronic publication. And we've been doing it for almost 5 years now.
Yeah, it's a wonderful resource for those of us in the field who work with twice exceptional kids. And I think what we all learn is the best practices that apply to twice exceptional kids are really best practices for all kids. So it's a great resource, I think, for all parents and all educators. So Mark, I know you follow all the education news closely each week, so tell us what's hot in the news this week.
Well, I'd like to start with a couple things that we reported on in the most recent issue of 2E Newsletter. They're both stories that feature what advocates can do and what they can achieve. In Colorado Springs, Colorado, there was a 2E advocate who figured out that awareness of twice exceptionalities would lead to funding, which would then lead to action, being able to do something for these kids. This advocate is an internal consultant on twice exceptional to a large school district. She managed to get the mayor's office in Colorado Springs to proclaim a twice exceptional awareness week.
That's great.
And along with that, she held an event that was called Kids Speak Out. She had several kids from the district talk about what it means to be twice exceptional and the various challenges that they face, the range of their various twice exceptionalities.
That sounds terrific. And when we talked to Samantha and Betsy, Samantha is a wonderful example of a twice exceptional student who has gone on to be very successful in many ways. So our listeners will learn more about twice exceptionality as we get into the show.
Well, one funny coincidence is that around the time that Colorado Springs proclaimed that week, I think both Samantha and Jonathan Mooney had been speaking in town in Colorado Springs.
Ah, I wonder if that was a spark or if that was just an outgrowth of some of the activities of the week.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I wanted to mention about advocates, there were a pair of parent advocates in Idaho who managed to get the attention of some people at the state level who understood the importance of providing services for twice exceptional students. And what came out of that effort is a committee in the state of Idaho that is working on developing a manual and then some training for teachers across the state on twice exceptionalities. Their goal is to just to be able to walk into any school in the state, and when they say the word twice exceptional, to have people understand exactly what they're talking about, because that doesn't happen now. A lot of times teachers and parents just don't know what you're talking about when you use that term. A lot of people still don't believe that you can be gifted and learning disabled at the same time.
Absolutely. I want to make our listeners aware there are a couple of great manuals already online that I know of. One was created by Daphne Peerless in Colorado, and it is online for the whole state of Colorado, but folks in other regions can also take a look at that. And then there is a guidebook from Montgomery County, Maryland, where I used to be the coordinator, that has been continually updated by the new coordinator, Marisa Stemple, and an active parent group, the GTLD network there, and that's a great model for other school systems as well.
Daphne is actually helping the Idaho group to develop their manual.
Oh, fabulous.
So is Lois Baldwin from Aegis. You know Lois from your work with
Lois. And Lois created the very first program for twice exceptional students in Westchester, New York. So she's been a real pioneer in this field. So, Mark, what about in education in general? Any other hot topics this week?
Well, one interesting thing was a report by the American Association of University Women that came out, and it was a report that concludes that girls have gained over the past decade in terms of academic achievement, but their gains have not come at boys' expense. That, you know, they're saying that this is not a zero-sum game. What they're trying to do is refocus attention on the real problems of education and get away from this, what they see as a distracting debate about, you know, boys' crisis and the boy versus girl thing. Their conclusion was that the largest disparities in educational achievement aren't between boys and girls, but between those of different races or ethnicities or income levels.
Right. And you know, I certainly wouldn't take any issue with that, but I do think there is merit to paying attention to what's happening with our boys in schools and to look at ways to improve educational practices for boys.
You have personal experience with that.
Absolutely, and at the same time, focus on our girls. And Terry New and I wrote a book called Helping Boys Succeed in School, where we really focus on boy-friendly strategies, but we make the point from the beginning that it's not about boys versus girls. We need to continue to pay attention to our daughters and look at strategies that are going to work to improve their educational experience. I just want to preview June 13th, our show will be dedicated to gender in our schools, meeting the needs of our sons and daughters. And we're going to have Terry New, my co-author from Helping Boys Succeed in School, and we're going to have Dr. David Sadker, who wrote a seminal work along with his late wife, Myra Sadker, that was called Failing at Fairness, which is actually being revised now, which really put the spotlight on girls' issues in education for the first time, that it was done in a widespread, very, very dynamic way in the early 90s. So we'll discuss both parts of the issue. But did you want to say anything else about that study that you uncovered in looking at that?
Well, it's kind of a follow-up to another early 90s study, I guess, that first focused on girls' success. And as I said, they found that income is a much more strong predictor of gender of differences in academic achievement than gender.
Yeah, I would also encourage people to look at there was a massive study in Great Britain called Raising Boys' Achievement, multi-year study. and had a lot of very specific recommendations for helping to raise boys' achievement that I haven't seen get much coverage or publicity in this country, but it's well worth looking at. What else did you see in the news, Mark? We have time, I think, for one more, to explore one more item.
Well, one thing that was in the news was a Newsweek ranking of high schools in the country, which was interesting to me because they ranked as many schools, high schools, as they could. They excluded elite schools that, you know, where there are no average students. But they ranked thousands of schools on just using one criteria, and that was the proportion of students who took college-level exams, the Cambridge, the International Baccalaureate, and Advanced Placement exams. So they counted the total number of those tests that were taken at the school by all students and then divided by the number of graduating seniors. So, you know, so say you got 300 people in the school, and they each took, you know, three of those tests. So that would be, that'd give you a ratio of three. And then you'd, that would give you 900, and that would, then they would divide by the number of graduating seniors. So they take this ratio, and based on that, they rank schools. The number one school was a public charter school in Tucson. It was called Basis. With 120 high schoolers and 18 graduates. They noticed, the article was written by Jay Matthews, who writes for Newsweek and is also an
editor. Also the Washington
writer.
Post.
Right, right. And he noticed a trend that over the years, smaller schools are becoming more and more prominent in this ranking. 10 years ago, he says, the first Newsweek list included, let's see, just three schools in the top 100 that had graduating classes smaller than 100 students, and this year there's 22.
That's very interesting. I know this challenge index has had a great impact on schools all across the country as schools strive to get their ranking up and, you know, be included among the top schools. And I know there's been a great increase in providing challenging courses to more and more students, removing some of the barriers to having to students enrolling in those courses, so that's been a, you know, a very positive thing. And it's interesting to hear about the small classes because Carol Ann Tomlinson told us a couple weeks ago on the show that while we know small classes, intuitively we know they're helpful, there's not a lot of research to show that, so maybe this is the beginning of seeing some research to show that. Mark, we're out of time for the first segment, but thank you so much for being with us. We're again going to offer a free subscription to the TUI newsletter for a caller who calls in today with a question, and we'll check back with you in future weeks. We'll be back after the break with Betsy and Samantha ABL. Thanks, Mark. Bye.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Are you paying too much for term life insurance? There's a price war among the major term life carriers. Consider these possible rates. A man age 45, non-tobacco user, could obtain $1 million of coverage for as little as $75 a month, and this rate is fixed for the next 10 years. We specialize in policies of $500,000 and above. A man age 50, non-tobacco user, may be able to obtain $500,000 of coverage for as little as $115 per month, and this rate is fixed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed not to change for 20 years. We have great rates for smokers too. For new or replacement term life insurance, call the Term Lifeline now. 800-890-5075. 800-890-5075. That's 800-890-5075.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible?
The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators, do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Hi, this is Rich Weinfeld. I'm hosting today solo. Michelle Davis is not available to be with us, but she will be back next week. We're thrilled today to have a mother and daughter together telling their story, which is a very powerful story. And let me take some time to introduce both of them to you. First of all, let me start with the mom, Betsy Abel, or Elizabeth. Elizabeth is an award-winning artist, teacher, and workshop leader. She has a degree in fine arts from St. Lawrence University. Along with her creating artwork for shows and galleries, her passion has been helping others to discover their creative spirit by teaching them a different way to see the world. She credits this type of creative vision as the inspiration and vehicle that helped her to raise her learning disabled daughter. And Elizabeth lives and works in Traverse City, Michigan, and has spoken at numerous events with Samantha on the topic of learning disabilities and the hard-won lessons she has acquired along the way. Her daughter, Samantha, is a public speaker and author of two books. She's a young woman with a learning disability whose life journey inspires audiences and gives hope to those facing and working to overcome obstacles. She speaks candidly about the difficulties of growing up with learning differences from elementary school all the way through graduate school and how it impacted her life and still does impact her life in the present. In her presentations, she talks about her wonderful book, My 13th Winter, which is a beautiful and haunting memoir. And she talks in detail about how her life was affected and is still affected by her learning differences, how she suffered anxiety attacks beginning in seventh grade. She struggled with the pressures of junior high, from balancing schoolwork to remembering locker combinations to social situations with her peers to the difficulty of explaining her learning differences with math to teachers who couldn't understand why a good student like Samantha wasn't excelling. I'm happy to have them both with me today. I'll finish Samantha's story by saying she has a degree in English from Mount Holyoke College and a master's in social work from the University of Michigan. She was first published at the age of 15, a book of beautiful poetry called Reach for the Moon, which won an award for best book on the subject of learning disabilities. And The 13th Winter has won an American Library Association Award. As I said before, she speaks at numerous conferences. I've heard her speak recently as a keynote, along with her mom, Betsy, at the Aegis Conference in Los Angeles. So I want to welcome Sam and Betsy to our show today. Are you guys with us?
Yes, thank you for having us, Rich. Thanks.
Okay. Great to have you. I know your voices are similar, so I'll address questions specifically to one or the other. And I want to first kind of go a little bit through your school journey, Sam, and have you tell us a little bit about that, and then I will also want to get your mom Betsy's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But can you start with your first experiences of school, which I believe were positive ones?
Yeah, you know, school initially I think was a good place. You have to remember that, you know, at least when I was young, I really didn't have any idea that anybody saw the world any differently than I did. So You know, I expected to fit right in with everyone and, you know, was able to make some friends and seemed to do pretty well with most of my academic stuff. And in general, you know, just was kind of a real creative kid that enjoyed enjoyed just sort of, I don't know, being presented with new material and learning new things. So I think for me, that's really kind of how school started off for me.
It's interesting. We had Jonathan Mooney, who I know you know, on the show a few weeks ago, and you know, he says, "I rocked kindergarten." That was a good time in life. Betsy, what were your first impressions when, you know, Samantha, not only in school, but just as a little girl, what did you think about her potential and capabilities?
Oh, I was sure that she was going to head off to school and be a superstar just because as a young child growing up, before she went off to school, she was just a verbal dynamo at home, so inquisitive and so curious about the world and had a capacity to memorize things. I just really had no idea what we were going to be heading into as the years went on with school. So kindergarten was my first indication at a parent-teacher conference when the teacher told me that she was somewhat shy and withdrawn, and all I could think of is that she must have the wrong
right.
She was talking about, because that was not my kid.
Yeah, so it sounded like not only did you think she would do well in school, you had reason to think that she was going to excel in school.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just never would have thought that she would struggle in any way.
So Sam, tell us about when you first started to feel the struggle, started to feel like something might be wrong with you as a student.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, my teachers first noticed, they were the ones who noticed first, and they sort of noticed that I think second grade is kind of when it really became apparent that I wasn't understanding things in the same way that other students were. And that's when they decided to have me tested, and those test results came back, and it turned out that I was really, really high in some areas, particularly sort of the verbal skills areas, and then I was really low in math, is sort of the main area where my scores really kind of fell off the charts. There was just this huge gulf between the two sets of test scores, and I think the school was really confused. They didn't really know what to do with someone who had that kind of profile, and really basically told my parents, you know, don't worry about it, she'll just even out. You know, just keep her in the regular ed classes and eventually things will sort of fall into the middle.
Do you remember, you know, being in second grade, and I just, mm-hmm. by the way, I just finished 13th winter, and very inspirational and very moving, and, you know, you really took the reader back to all these stages in your life, which I thought was very powerful. Can you talk about yourself as a second grader and, you know, do you remember what you were feeling about yourself as a student at that time?
Yeah, you know, I got a lot of feedback, a lot of positive feedback about the things that I did well in school. I was definitely kind of a teacher's pet, so, you know, I had a really positive relationship with my teachers at that point. You know, really got a lot of positive feedback, seemed to excel in a lot of things, especially art and writing and that kind of stuff. But when we would do math in school in classes, that's when things would, you know, sort of become harder for me. And there were times where we would do these time tests in school, and that was just awful because I really could not keep up with the rest of the students, really had no idea. But I think while I was really struggling with that stuff, while I was struggling with math, it still wasn't as overwhelming yet as it became later on for me. So second grade was a challenge in some ways. There were sort of these slight little moments where I started to feel anxious and realized, I'm not quite getting this like everyone else. But I think for me, it really didn't hit me until fourth grade, that emotional sense of, wow.
I want to come back to that. But Betsy,
yeah.
Take us your perspective back in second grade. Were you instrumental in getting her tested, or did that come from the school? And how did you feel about that whole process?
Yeah, what happened was her teacher sort of clued me in that, gee, Sam seemed to be a little bit behind in the understanding of the basic flashcards and addition subtraction, and that it would be good if I would spend some time working with her at home on those things. So that was no problem. I got the flashcards and sat down with her one night, and that truly was a night that completely changed my life. I had no idea what we were up against, and a simple flashcard, 5 minus 2 equals 3, and she was utterly clueless. And I demonstrated it in, you know, in every way possible. I put things in front of her and then took them away and had her count how many were left. You know, I went through every manipulative I could possibly think of, and it was like I was watching this movie unfold of someone who was completely unable to grasp the concept, and I could not.
Here's your brilliant verbal little girl. You had such high expectations for her. How did you put this new information into that puzzle? How did that fit?
Oh, it just absolutely freaked me out.
Yeah.
I can still remember that moment as if it was yesterday, and it was the most haunting, puzzling, scary, frightening, disjointed thing, and it made absolutely no sense to me.
So when this testing came back from the school, and as Samantha described it, you know, don't worry, it's all just going to even out over time. We don't really need to do anything special. Did you trust that? How did you react to that?
Well, I was the one that went back to the school the next morning with this, you know, revelation that I'd just gone through with her and saying, yeah, something is clearly not right. What can we do? And that's when they suggested that she be tested and that was a possibility. So I signed on the dotted line for that right away.
Mm-hmm.
And when we sat down with the results, Sam was my first child, and the room was full of professionals, and all of them had lots of advanced degrees, and we had social workers and psychologists and school principals and educators. Everybody was there, and I remember my husband and I feeling that their recommendation didn't feel right in our stomachs, but then these were the professionals.
It's so hard as a parent, you know, even no matter how bright you are, however knowledgeable you are, sit in a room with that many professionals, you do question your own judgment.
Yeah, completely. And so, you know, the decision to leave her where she was never felt right, but they were so unified in their approach and suggestion that, you know, she is so bright, she will clearly make up for her deficits. So we were told not to worry about her, and that in any math instance, she could always use a calculator.
Right.
Well, the flaw in that thinking was that you have to know what you're doing with a calculator.
Right. So take us ahead, Betsy, take us ahead, and Samantha mentioned that by fourth grade, she could feel that things weren't working. What was your perception at that time?
Yeah, we had one little reprieve. Second grade was still a bit of a nightmare, but we had one little reprieve in third grade because she did have such an uncanny capacity for memorization that when they were working with multiplication, she memorized the multiplication tables. So she basically fooled all of us into thinking problems were solved.
Right, and that, I want to say to parents who might be listening, often very bright kids can get by in both math and reading through their memorization, but as time goes on, problems become more evident. We're gonna take a brief break and then come back and continue to hear Samantha's story from Samantha ABL and Betsy ABL. We'll be back after the break.
Your life, your health, your network. Voice America Health and Wellness.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs. I start to cough.
Did you know your child's asthma attacks can be triggered by things like shower curtains, a blanket, even a teddy bear?
I feel like I'm choking.
And there are many other things in your home and your child's classroom you may not know about. For the latest information, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Help prevent your child's asthma attacks and avoid the emergency room. Call toll-free 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Or visit www.noattacks.org.
I don't want to feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Hi, this is Rich Weinfeld, and I want to remind our listeners that besides calling in, you can also email us at specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com. We're with Samantha Abiel, author of Reach for the Moon and My 13th Winter, and her mom, Betsy Abiel, and we're hearing Samantha's story from a mom and daughter perspective. I wanted to fast forward a little bit to middle school and Sam, to hear you talk a little bit about how, you know, what started out as maybe just a kind of minor thing with math, how is your learning disability now affecting your school life and your life in general? Right. Sam?
The skills I built up just disappeared. And I think for me, you know, the hard things were I had two locker combinations to remember, and I can barely keep those things straight, so just trying to get things out of my locker was very stressful. I had, I think it was 6 minutes between classes, and I lived in constant fear of being late for class, and I never knew how long 6 minutes was. So I was constantly stressed out about having to try to get to classes on time and not be late for things.
I want to pause on that for a second because, you know, I in reading my 13th Winter, it became clear how important not just the mathematics part of your disability was, but the whole time piece that you're talking about now, telling time, being able to measure time, knowing how long you had, not just to change classes, but for long-term assignments, that seems to be have had a major impact throughout your life.
Yes, and it continues to. You know, time management is a huge part of being successful as an adult and young adult, and, well, even in high school and junior high, those things really come into play. And when you don't have a sense of time, it's pretty tough to manage time. It started to really, really take on this sort of stressful role, especially for someone who, at least I was someone who really wanted to do well and wanted to achieve and, you know, wanted to accomplish things. And to do that stuff and not be able to know how to fit it into my day or manage my time, it was a real struggle, a real struggle.
So middle school is an intense social time for all kids, and it's a time when kids are really measuring themselves against others and incredibly self-conscious about what other people think about them.
Yeah.
So I can, you know, I know that it was a very hard time for you. Can you talk a little bit about the social piece?
Yeah, it's really tough. You know, when you're 15 years old, all you want to do is fit in. You just want to be like everyone else.
Right.
You don't want to be different. And I had these things about me that I couldn't, you know, I could try to sort of pretend weren't there, but the reality was they were. You know, I was different. I did have things about me that that did make life a struggle. And so I was constantly fighting this battle of trying to look like I was normal, act like I fit in, but inside constantly felt like I was just didn't belong. You know, I just didn't fit. And it was very stressful.
And academically, obviously math continued to be a problem. Were other areas a problem as well?
Math was definitely the main struggle for me, but I also did struggle with spelling and grammar. Those things were very hard for me. I had a hard time keeping those things straight, you know, where you put the comma, what an adverb is, all of that stuff. Learning a foreign language, my poor ninth grade French teacher, I feel so bad for her. She stayed after school every day trying to help me learn, you know, French, and it was just such an impossible impossible task, I think, for both of us.
Yeah. So Betsy, from your perspective, you know, we left you where the school team had told you, well, everything's going to even out, and then obviously things are not evening out. You have a brilliant daughter who's having incredible problems. So how did you interface with the school and middle school, and when did the special education identification process begin again?
Well, it was a real struggle through all of her elementary years. I kept trying to be heard, basically, that we really had problems at home. She was having panic attacks. Her anxiety levels were off the charts. So I kept trying to find the right person, the right place to take this kind of information and to get some help with it. And it really was just not being heard. So those first 6-7 years in school were just repeated efforts and failure on my part to be able to get the help that she needed. Eventually, we found a guidance counselor when she hit 7th grade that was very understanding of, he took the time to really hear what I was saying about her. And the first blessing was he handpicked her teachers for 7th grade, and he found an English teacher that he knew would tap into the strengths that she was showing as a writer, and a math teacher that he thought would have the patience of a saint. And so that was the beginning. Meanwhile, I was still trying to get the administration to address her strengths and her weaknesses, because it was becoming apparent she would really need to have identification to be able to possibly have the chance to go to college. We would need a label that she just was not able to get.
I want to go to Samantha's book, My 13th Winter, for a minute and read for the listeners Samantha's account of the IEP meeting where you finally did get identification for Sam as a learning disabled student. She writes, "Some felt that my parents were overreacting and believed that they, particularly my mother, were the problem. They accused my mom and dad of being overprotective, and they proposed that my parents were the ones who put the idea in my head that I couldn't do math. They suggested that was the reason I performed so poorly. Several in the meeting pointed to my overall high grades and achievements in other subjects and claimed that labeling me as a special needs student and granting me special services was unjustified. At one point during the meeting, a special ed teacher leaned across the table and said to my mother, 'Do you have any idea what you will be doing to your daughter by placing her in a room with those kinds of kids?' My mom felt intimidated, frustrated, and was close to tears as the meeting drew to a close. The atmosphere was tense and divided. My guidance counselor, who had remained quiet throughout the meeting, now chose to speak. Calmly and concisely, he reminded everyone of my grade-level testing results, which, according to school standards, qualified me for special services. He reminded them of my many struggles and noted that even though I wasn't failing, his evaluation was based on my work ethic. My teacher's evaluation was based on my work ethic, not on my comprehension. As he made a special personal appeal, sharing his belief that getting me help via special education was the right thing to do, the committee came around to making that decision." I just thought that was, I'm in IEP meetings every day as an advocate for kids, and that was such a accurate and vivid description of so many meetings I'm in and of the things that are said in so many meetings. Betsy, your reaction hearing that?
It certainly takes me back. And really the key to getting Sam help was when she was tested in the standard way, and I'm sure you know the names of the tests, and I've in some ways tried to forget the name of the test, but those tests were, they did show this discrepancy, but her strengths were always overriding the weakness that was also very pervasive. And it wasn't until I went into to the director of special education's office one day, just total frustration, and said to him, "We can't continue. We are losing our daughter in terms of her panic and anxiety, depression. She wasn't eating. She wasn't able to have any sort of a social life whatsoever. So I was scared for her on multiple levels. And when I went in and sat down in his chair and I said, "Mike, I can't leave this office without something changing." And that was the time when he finally looked at me and he said, "Okay, let's, you know, what can I do?" So he came up with this idea of grade level testing.
Yeah.
And he took out the what are you supposed to know when you end at first grade with math? What are you supposed to know at second grade? And he hired a teacher to come in and test her over the summer for these grade level objectives. And she was entering eighth grade and about to have to do whatever the standard eighth grade math was. And the tester came up to him after like a day and a half and just said, "She can't even get out of second grade."
Right, right. I want to read again from my 13th winter short excerpt about Samantha's first day in special ed with those kids. "I look around and I feel heartened by the realization that no one else in the room gets it either, that we all struggle with math and it's okay. The realization is comforting, freeing. For the first time in my life, the pressure is off. I can breathe. I'm not expected to get it. In fact, it's okay that I don't, and I'm not in the minority. No one around me is whispering about how easy this is or how they know the answer. The questions I want to ask aren't dumb, and it's all right if I ask them over and over again. I feel relaxed, at ease. Here, after all those years of fear and withdrawal, I can finally start raising my hand in class again." And you conclude that chapter, Sam, by saying, "Special education saved my life," which is pretty dramatic. tell us a little bit, how did it feel to be placed in special education?
Well, leading up to that point, I was having panic attacks on almost a daily basis. You know, I wasn't eating. I wasn't spending time with friends anymore. I'd completely withdrawn. You know, it was just really a mess, and emotionally and in every other way. And when I was finally labeled as learning disabled and placed in the special ed math class, it was like this huge weight got lifted. I suddenly realized it's not my fault. You know, there's just something about my brain that doesn't process things, you know, in a certain way. And so it was just this huge feeling of relief and this relief.
And some would argue, like, you know, the special educator leaned over the table that, you know, it would be stigmatizing to be in that class. You didn't feel that?
No, you know, so often that's what I hear people's concerns is they really worry about the stigmatization of special education and on children. And I think, you know, yes, there are stigmas out there. There are, you know, kids who do suffer from a lot of bullying and all that because of the fact that they're placed in special education classes. But for me, I don't know if it was the right moment, the right timing. I'm not really sure. But for me, it was actually a very freeing, relieving, wonderful thing to finally know that it wasn't my fault. And
can I interject one thing? It was also the right teacher. She had
a
truly gifted special education teacher.
Can't underestimate the importance of the teacher. We're gonna have to go to break again, and we'll be back with Samantha and Betsy A. Beale to talk about Samantha's journey beyond junior high school. Back in a minute.
Helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
Life can be full of risks. One thing you shouldn't take a risk with ever is your family's health insurance. If you're self-employed or an individual and you need affordable health insurance, you need to make this free call right now and see how the Mega Life and Health Insurance Company can help you get it. We specialize in helping the self-employed and individuals just like you who need affordable health insurance to get it. So call us right now. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. 859-4825. Don't take a risk with your family's health insurance. It's not worth it. If you're self-employed or an individual and you need affordable health insurance, call us now and see how we can help you. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. Home office, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Not available in all states. Benefits may vary by state.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators, do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
Children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. Rich Weinfeld, your host, and my co-host Michelle Davis is not with us today. She'll be back next week, and our show next week will focus on teaching to the strength. What does it mean to be a gifted student? We'll explore all the issues around and involved with gifted education with Joyce Van Tassel-Baska, who is past president of the National Association for Gifted Children and the creator of the William and Mary curriculum, which is a wonderful, rigorous, challenging curriculum that many school systems have adopted for challenging students at the highest level of thinking. Today we're visiting with Samantha A. Beale, author of Reach for the Moon and also My 13th Winter, and her mom, Betsy A. Beale, and talking about Samantha's journey as a twice exceptional student through public school and her continuing journey on into her young adult life. We were just talking before the break about junior high school and about when Samantha was finally identified for special education and how that was a huge relief for both parents and daughter. And Sam, I want to pick up the story with something very special that happened in your life in middle school or junior high school. And that was the working on the book of poetry, Reach for the Moon. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be and your feelings around that time?
Yeah, you know, at the time it was basically seventh grade is when I kind of started work on my first poems for the book Reach for the Moon. And what had happened was I was struggling so much in my math class and just in school in general and trying to fit in and be a part of things. The one thing that I seemed to really enjoy or had a talent for that really kind of stood out was the writing. That was really something that, you know, kind of became my life preserver, I guess is the best way to put it, you know. It really was what kept me afloat. And so seeing that, my mom decided to maybe ask my English teacher if she'd be willing to work with me on maybe like an outside project. You know, if your kid is good at piano, you might try to get them piano lessons. What my mom did was sort of set me up with my seventh grade writing teacher and ask her if she'd be willing to work with me over the summer, actually, on some writing stuff. And actually, a good friend of ours who did the watercolors in the book, he was generous enough to drop off some slides of his artwork. And I basically spent part of that school year and summer writing poetry to his paintings and his pictures. And my teacher would kind of help edit and really taught me a lot as I went along. And it was a wonderful experience, and it became this place where I could escape and really feel good about myself and about, you know, what I was doing. And I think it really did help pull me through that really awful time.
You know, it's interesting to me as someone who works a lot with what I call smart kids with learning difficulties. writing is often a very problematic area, and I know that writing could have been a problematic area for you if you focused on your weaknesses, your spelling, your grammar. Why didn't that stop you? How were you able to keep going and develop this talent despite the fact that you had some weaknesses in that area?
I think a lot of it had to do with my teachers, and really what happened to me was back in fifth and sixth grade, up until that point, writing had always just been grammar and spelling. We copied sentences out of English textbooks. It was extremely boring for me and difficult, and I never did well at it. So I hated English. I hated writing. And it wasn't until I think it was fifth or sixth grade I had a teacher who passed out pictures from National Geographic, mm-hmm. and she said, you know, I ended up with a picture of a painted turtle, and she said, you know, I don't want you guys to worry about spelling and grammar. All I want you to do is write. The most important thing are your thoughts and your ideas, and I just want you to get them down on paper. And so I started writing this paragraph about this turtle in this picture, and it was like the whole world just disappeared. And it was just me and my writing in that moment in time, and I just had so much to say. There were so many thoughts that I was always thinking in my head but never realized that writing was a way to communicate them. Writing is just talking on paper. If you take away, you know, all of the things that were problematic for me, suddenly my thoughts and ideas were really rich and there on the page. And so she really kind of fostered that in me, and then I lucked out in basically having a wonderful teacher in seventh grade who was willing to view it the same way. She knew I had trouble with grammar and spelling, but she was willing to overlook some of that and really look at my writing in terms of its ideas and its thoughts. She helped me kind of find out ways to sort of work on my grammar and spelling, I guess. But she didn't use that as the end-all, be-all in terms of rating my papers and, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Betsy, I when I heard you speak at the Aegis Conference in Los Angeles, you know, a couple of things that really came through as a message to other parents were focus on what your child can do. Remember, it doesn't necessarily have to be school-related, but focusing on that strength or talent can often lead to a career. And look for mentors outside the home. Those relationships validate a child's talents. Can you talk about your role in helping to identify Samantha's strengths and make these partnerships both in the school and in the community that were so profound in Samantha's life?
Right. I wish I could say that I knew what I was doing when I was doing it. I was driven more by instinct and not really a lot of knowledge. But my instinct was that if you focus on what you can't do, and that's all you beat a kid up with is what they can't do, how can they possibly feel good about themselves? So it just seemed so logical to go after the things that she could do and support the heck out of them, because the things that she couldn't do, she was certainly beating herself up hard enough for all the world. So I looked for this teacher to help her, and the artist that did the illustrations in the book was a friend of mine, and he was very willing to have an adult relationship with her, in the sense that he took her work seriously. He didn't consider her a little kid that he was just sort of placating.
Right.
And the two of them would sit down and they'd actually talk about the paintings and what Charlie was after, and Sam would communicate her thoughts about writing. And I could see her blossom with this wonderful attention from adults outside of her dad and I just telling her that she was okay at something.
Yeah, I can't applaud you enough. I mean, the best practices that we talk about in my book, Smart Kids for Learning Difficulties, and in the Special Needs Advocacy Resource book, are, number one, to focus on the strength and develop the strength, and at the same time, not to neglect helping the child improve in their areas of weakness. And, you know, in seventh grade, you were doing both things. You were finding ways to work on that strength, and you were fighting to get her identified to work on the areas that she was struggling with. So I really do applaud you. Sam, what I hear in your talk is how important this special teacher was and how much she meant to you and just the way she taught and her partnership with you. I know you have a poem in your Reach for the Moon book, To a Special Teacher. Do you have that handy?
I do.
Could you please read that for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
To a Special Teacher. When the sun rose from under its misty veil, you were there to watch, like the birds over the sea. When the wind came quietly and rested in your ear, you listened as the earth would at dawn. When the rain fell, you reached out your hands and let it wash everything away, like waves as they grasped the shore. When the plain brown seed was planted, you could already smell the fragrance of the flower that was to come, and you were proud, as a good gardener should be. Thank you for believing that there was a flower waiting inside and for taking the time to help and watch it grow. When the sun rose from under its misty veil, you were there to watch, and I am thankful.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's part of a beautiful collection of poetry, Reach for the Moon. I encourage listeners to go to Amazon or elsewhere and purchase that. I use it in all my trainings. I was using it before I met Samantha and Betsy, and now it has even more meaning for me. Appreciate so much the two of you being on with us today, sharing your story and the inspiration of it. I know that it's a lifelong journey, still full of lots of challenges, but I really admire the way the two of you are facing that. So thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's edition of Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. Join your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Teach your children well, their father's health did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Your life.